Let's have the discussion. You're listening to Canter with Scott and Adam.
Adam, I saw your hand shaking as you dropped that fader, mate.
I'm nervous, but also very, very excited.
Yeah, man. And when we started Canter, we had some names at the top of the list, and the very top of the list is here with us today, man. Guys, we're super fortunate to have Arjan Roskam and Joel Helms on the line. Two absolute legends of the game. They've built an absolute behemoth in the Greenhouse Seed Company, Greenhouse Coffee Shops, Strain Hunters, Greenhouse Medical, just to name a few. Guys, thank you so much for giving us your time.
Yeah, man.
Thank you very much for inviting us.
An honor to be on the Australian podcast, guys. Love it.
Yeah.
So, guys, I just listed some of the businesses that you guys have started. All monumental businesses. You know, I think the coffee shop scene in Amsterdam has a lot to thank you guys for. The seed scene, particularly yourself, Arjan, has a lot to thank you for. Even the medical scene with Greenhouse Medical and what you guys are doing over there, and then the pop culture scene with Strain Hunters. It's all. I mean, anybody in the cannabis space knows those names that I've just said, all products of you guys. So tell us a little bit about what you guys do, what you're all about.
You?
Yeah.
You have some time?
We got time, man.
It all started off as a grower, like most of the people in the industry, like a private grower. And basically, I love plants, and I just like to breed and grow plants. That's my main passion. And from that main passion, coffee shops came because I needed to sell the product somewhere to make money, of course. And then from that again, Strain Hunters emerged, which is, of course, the most fun thing to do is go 3 weeks with your friends into the mountains and go have a nice smoke and encounter crazy things and find great pots and learn from other cultures and all that kind of stuff, you know? So yeah, that's in a nutshell, Greenhouse and Strain Hunters.
Now, Joa, you're the CEO of the Greenhouse Coffee Shops, founded by Arjan. Can you tell us a little bit about how you've seen the coffee shop scene evolve from the day you walked in the door, and also tell us a little bit how you guys hooked up and, how you made your way into becoming the CEO of this chain, massive chain.
Yeah, of course. I was always a cannabis enthusiast, you know, even way before the Greenhouse, because first Greenhouse started in 92, right?
Yeah.
I joined in 1995, but, you know, I've been smoking before 92. So, you know, I saw the other coffee shops in Amsterdam. And I must say, Amsterdam really has a coffee shop culture more than the cannabis culture, if you know what I mean. So, you know, we have the culture where we get together and we smoke some weed, you know, we play some games and chat with each other. But, you know, the cannabis that we smoked wasn't really like somebody would say, hey, man, this is a nice cross of this one and that one. And, you know, it's or the hash that we smoked, you know, wherever it came from, you know, we used to play pool and those kind of things. And then I left to America in 1994, I think, something like that, to study at UCSD. And then I became a bit more acquainted with the cannabis culture, you know. So I met people from Normal. I got a little bit more involved with the activism, the, you know, trying to normalize the cannabis. And that really got my attention, you know. So when I came back in 1995, I was looking for a job to you know, pay the rent just like any other young guy, you know. And then I was sitting in the greenhouse and having a tea, and then I remember Arjan was he doesn't even remember, but they were having interviews, you know. And I think there were a massive amount of people. I think there were like 100 guys there, you know. And I was like, what is all this stuff going on here? And I thought, I might as well go for an interview. So we had a little chat, and, you know, I saw he wrote a little thing in the corner of the paper. I was like, I don't know if that's good or bad. But then the next day I got a phone call, and I could start as a bartender, you know. And then from day one, I loved it. Obviously, I'm still here, you know. And then I started working in the greenhouse, and then that's exactly the time when the High Times Cannabis Cup really took off, you know, became really popular. And it's been a roller coaster since, actually. You know, all the companies that you mentioned happened all over the years, and it's been a ride, you know, and it's still interesting to this day.
So basically, you're 26 years with us. We missed your 25 year anniversary.
I don't know if I can swear, but this fucking COVID ruined my, you know.
You didn't get the watch.
Yeah.
Typical stoner meltdown. Yeah.
Oh, shit. It's my, you know, anniversary.
25 year anniversary.
Yeah.
Now, Ayad, you are, everybody that I've met from your organization has been a cannabis person. And a lot of them seem to have come to you via being patrons of your coffee shops. Can you tell us a little bit about your recruitment? Because one thing I've noticed with all of you guys, they're all lovely people. They're all intelligent, and they're all they're like free thinking guys. They're pretty creative guys, and it stands out as something that's consistent amongst your team. Are those the sort of things that you look for when you're employing people, or are you looking at pieces of paper? You know, what's their degree? What's their background?
Yeah, well, it's a mix of everything. Mostly feeling. You know, you need to feel things. This is my I have a autistic part in my body, and when we design stuff, I'd rather see it right in front of me on paper than on a screen. And like most people, for example, Franco was the best example. Franco was working in a Waterloo Plant coffee shop, which is our smallest coffee shop in a little neighborhood outside of the center. And in 2000, we had the first medical license in Holland with Sim, and I needed a grower. And this was a very, very hard job at that time, because inside it was 50 degrees Celsius, was a glass house, and a lot of issues I'm not going to explain right now. And my wife said to me, there's this Italian guy who's like super passionate about marijuana. He's like crazy, she said. I said, okay, how crazy is he? He said, he's crazy. He's just not talking to the plants. So, okay, let's go check out this guy. And I was going through my papers to find a proper guy with some kind of background, you know. And so we find him through that. So people already come to the greenhouse because they're very motivated to work in our industry. And then they want to work with greenhouse, obviously. Like, there's more good coffee shops, but of course, we are one of the ones that, Pep, if you're young, you would like to come and work here with all the celebrities and all the marijuana and all these kind of things. So it's kind of an automatic process, you know. And I have some great people on the in the office that came through our history of Amsterdam. Like, Marcel is running the show now there. And Marcel is an old friend of mine for 25 years. He was working at a club in management where that club went broke, and I already told him 10 years, hey mate, if you have no more job, please always come to us, because, you know, we can do something together. That's how he came. And Yellow, for example, came through Heiko, and Heiko came through Franco, because they were together on boarding school. So there's a chain of things, you know. And mostly we got it right, but even Yo and me, with all our experience, sometimes you still hire a person that you think is great and is not so great, you know, because whatever issues, you know, mental or not capable of what they say they're doing. And yeah, like Jan, for example, is a whole other story. He came through the system, and that's a system of CVs and dedication. And you also look at the geographic background, you know, like Italians are like really hard workers, dedicated. Same for the Germans, very precise, you know. So for us also in Europe here, we know a little bit, you know, already, okay, he's German, he can be very good, you know. And so, it's just a feeling, you know, how to build up this company. And, of course, it's a very complicated company, because, like, now with Strain Hunters, Dust is going to replace Franco. Which is kind of a unicum, you know. We didn't yet tell this in the media, but you guys got the first goat for that.
You're a legend.
So we're gonna start
scoop.
Making
you got a scoop.
You got scoop. So we're gonna start making new Strain Hunter movies. Yesterday we had a big meeting, and 2 months ago we had a big meeting We were already going to shoot one in September last year, but you can imagine with COVID and my team in America and team in Italy and in Spain, it's difficult to get everybody on the spot. So now we're aiming for April, May, and then again September. And so Dust, of course, is the ideal character. You know, Dust also, we recruited Dust through the internet because 6 years ago, we started the Strain Hunter Forum. And I wanted to have more people with knowledge that can answer, because there's so many questions coming into the question area that we can't answer anything if we don't have a proper team there. And he was the guy always answering everything. And it turned out to be that he is, yeah, he's one of the best growers in the world. And he's probably got Dinos for terps. Yeah. So, and he's a super nice guy and he's very photogenic. So we said, okay, listen, so he's going to be the new guy, you know? So like that, you keep moving around. And of course we have the great Oscar, who is, well, you probably follow Oscar on his Instagram. He probably makes the best micros in the world. Very passionate guy too, a little crazy, speaks very funny English. So he's going to be the other character now, that's, you know, cool. So he's going to be really cool. Actor slash still guy. So yeah, that's just, you know, it's just a kind of a natural involvement in things. But yeah, we do get advice from people around us. I'm very open to advice. You know, we like to work in a team and put all the options on the table. So like now we're coming out with a new seed packaging, which is looking amazing. We're coming out with a new catalog, which looks amazing. But it's a team effort to create this product, you know.
But it's kind of tricky nowadays because, of course, what you see in Canada and America. Well, the situation is not like how it was 25 years ago, of course, you know. We started off really like a family kind of thing, and that's how it was growing. But now you see in Canada and everywhere, of course, becoming much more corporate, you know. So we do want to grow as a company, but we still hire all the people. And for us, the familiar thing is much more important than, you know, becoming huge as a company. We already had multiple opportunities to sell the company, for example, but we would never go for that, you know. We would never want to grow the company as big that we're not connected with it anymore. So we'd like that familiar thing, and you know, we you see sometimes things in America and Canada where it becomes too corporate, if you know what I mean. You know, you speak to 20 people and they never even smoked a joint, so then it becomes you're on a different level.
Yeah, speaking to the Dutch Passion guys as well, they've said, you know, as soon as they see the suits and the smooth talking businessmen, for them it's a red flag. Do you guys feel similar, that there's a few sort of sharks out there that are changing the game?
It was funny when this all started like 10, 12 years ago, when in America, you know, the legalization started becoming more commercial, but even before Canada. I remember me and Ayan, we were, you know, receiving a group coming from, I think, from America. And we were just in shorts and, you know, flip-flops, you know, just probably, you know, in our beachwear. And then this group came and there were like six lawyers and one guy, you know, one guy speaking with us. We were in a huge meeting and we were just in our, you know, beach outfit. And they were all lawyers. Or like, you know.
They came with two private planes.
Yeah. Like, what is going on with our industry, you know? Yeah. So already in the beginning, we saw this coming, of course, you know, and then a lot of our expectations became true when we see that they don't really have the feeling with the cannabis industry. And I think that's where it's going wrong with a lot of companies. And for us, it's the most important that we never lose that, you know?
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, funny. It's funny your question, because sometimes we get these. Some people say, yeah, you guys are McDonald's, you know, and have a little bit of negative approach about that. But I don't know why. We just have nice coffee shops. We have a nice seed company. And we make movies, you know.
Do you know what it is, Ayan? Yeah, you're too big.
5 years, you know.
People hate, people in society hate people achieving too much. And they hate the success. And it's a weird thing. And it's something I want to cover with you a little bit later after, because I feel like you guys get targeted a bit.
Yeah.
We might as well cover it while we're talking about it, because this in Australia, you might be familiar with it, Ayan, we call it the tall poppy syndrome. We're happy for the underdog to achieve success, but once they get too big, people start trying to cut them down, and it's a horrible trait in human nature. And I think it's horrible that people within the cannabis scene, cannabis people attacking other cannabis people. It's frigging horrible. I think we've all got to understand that if we've got to stick together. Otherwise, like you say, these corporates, they'll change the game and they'll cut us out. So we've got to stick together. We've got to look after each other. And you guys are, every one of you guys, I've been to your business several times. You're all cannabis people. There's no doubt. You leave the place thinking, yeah, these guys, you're all passionate. You all love it. So this concept that you guys are a McDonald's is garbage.
No, but we, to be honest with you, we kind of have a natural ability to shield ourselves for this kind of negativity. You know, we know it's going on, and we know there's haters out there. We believe, you know, you're probably not successful if you don't have some haters, you know, so, and probably maybe even more if you have more haters, but we really don't get involved in those discussions. We know who we are and where we came from, and we know how we are with all the people around us. And, you know, when we go to expos and, you know, fairs and to America and, you know, on our travels, we know how we are with all the people, and we're having the best time of our life still today, you know, so we're not really affected by that negativity.
No, we just kind of shield away from it, you know. You can see us on Instagram. Me and Yo, we have our own Instagram. We reply to people. You know, we even like that, we are involved. And yeah, we don't smoke before 5 o'clock in the afternoon because both of us don't get nothing going then. And then and some people complain, you should be smoking the whole day. Well, I don't want to be smoking the whole day, you know. I want to go for a run in the woods and I will smoke my joint at 9 o'clock in the night.
Yeah, it's one thing Yella told me that you have a straight rule. You don't smoke at work. You're there to work. You're there to get results. And after work, that's when you sit down with your mates.
Some people get away with smoking at work. Like Franco was the perfect example. You could have smoked 20 joints and it was going even harder.
Yeah.
But for me, with my autistic background, the moment I smoke a joint at 12 o'clock, I'm going to look to Yo and say, hey, listen, mate, let's go call the Japanese restaurant and go eat Japanese. And you know what's going to happen when you go to a Japanese restaurant? You're going to drink sake and that's the end of the day, yeah?
Yeah. Now, I want to talk a little bit
about holiday. It's good on a holiday, but not every day of the week. You know?
Yeah, that's cool. I want to talk a little bit about your guest to the coffee shop, Yoa.
Yeah.
Pink, Eminem, Kevin Spacey, Sacha Baron Cohen, Lenny Kravitz, Tony Hawk, Mike Tyson, Wesley Snipes, 50 Cent, Simply Red, System of a Down, Metallica, Cypress Hill, Wu-Tang Clan, Andre 3000, The Black Crowes, Gwen Stefani, Richard Branson, Snoop Dogg, Rihanna, Jason Mraz. Man, that's exhausting just to say it.
Yeah, you stopped 8 years ago, man.
Yeah, exactly. That's as far as your timeline goes on your photos on your website because you've had too many people through. Mate, part of the celebrity thing and part of getting the haters is, man, people get jealous, I guess, of seeing you guys achieve such a level of success. I mean, there are Michelin star restaurants that wouldn't have had a guest list like that through their doors. The world's greatest clubs would struggle to get a list like that. What is it about you guys that brings these superstars to hang out with you?
Well, basically, you know, just being able to be normal with those people, you know? I mean, if you are Rihanna or you're, you know, Eminem, if you see what's going on around them, that's surreal. That's not, I mean, they don't have a normal, they can't walk around the street and, you know, be normal like the rest of us, you know. So when they come to the greenhouse, basically what we offer them is there's, you know, living room and their home away from home. It sounds very cheesy, but it is really true, you know. They come there, they're like, oh man, I'm home, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we just smoke some weed, we eat some food, watch some Straight Hunter movies, and you know,
nothing will leak out. The only thing we put is picture.
Yeah,
but anything that's said or done, or you know, silly things happened a lot. You know, like seriously a lot, like huge scandals. But we could cover everything.
That's awesome. So you keep your dignity, and you keep theirs for them as well, which is really cool.
Hang out privately with them, also in America. You know, like guys from System of a Down. You know, and Woody Harrison and all those guys, they're great friends of us.
I
sleep in their house.
Yeah, man.
So it's just a different, you know, I don't know,
trust.
Just get along well with them, you know?
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. So one of those guests I spoke about, Richard Branson. Now, I want to get onto the advocacy a little bit that you and he, you guys have collaborated with him a little on advocacy for cannabis legalization. Is that correct?
Yeah, we 2012. Yeah, Transplant Cake? 2012, we organized the transplantcaketon.nl. That was to legalize the back door of supplying marijuana to the coffee shops in Holland. And I think at that time, he was already in his United Nations committee with Kofi Annan, Madeleine Albright, all those big shots. And we had, how you say that? Start. We had the naughty shoes on to give him a call. And also Soros at that time, which was already controversial. And they all donated some money and made some statements to help us. And that's when we started that whole group, which in the end turned in now that 10 licenses are granted in Holland. Unfortunately, we didn't get one, but 10 licenses got granted. And from the 500 coffee shops that are in Holland, 79 now will get provided in the next 2 to 4 years with marijuana as an experiment. So he was just one of the many characters that we approached, and he gladly helped out and put a few good words in for us. And I think he also helped out financially with some money, but I'm not sure about that. I'll have to look back. And that's what we did with Richard Branson.
How much, when you get a character like that, or a personality like that, sort of putting their, I guess, their reputation on the line to help you with your cause, how much does it help you? Did you feel it within the community that there was a bit of a groundswell at the time?
Yeah, it helps a lot because you need people like that to push the good cause. You know what I mean? You probably know, you know, there's in every, even in every serious television program, in any political discussion you have on television, they always show Cheech and Chong, you know, a little clip, or, you know, a long-haired guy smoking some weed, you know, that's the stereotype, right? So people always like to point that out. So it's important for the people to see that, you know, people take us serious, and this is a serious matter in the end, right? I mean, cannabis is such a popular way of, you know, spending your free time, and so many people enjoy it that basically it's a human right for the people to know exactly what they're smoking, and that it's been grown in a professional way, you know, no pesticides, things like that. So so the cannabis user, he has the same rights as a guy who drinks a beer, you know, and he gets a bottle with a label on and it says exactly what's inside, you know. So of course cannabis is fun, and it's nice to do it, but also it's basically a serious matter. It's ridiculous that it's illegal in so many countries, and it was back then, it was illegal in almost all countries, you know. So it was a cause that we thought was really important, that we have to fight for, and still to this day, you know. And not just the legalization, but also the normalization of cannabis, that, you know, people just accept it as any other, you know, as any person that drinks a white wine on Friday afternoon, because they want to chill, you know.
Exactly.
It's a good question you ask, because basically our activism comes from here, you know. Like, in the background, we are doing a huge amount of work. One of them was that lots of our own money and seven other big groups in Holland, we organized this chain to regulate the back door of marijuana. But it started much earlier because I've been 12 years spokesman for the Cannabis Retailers Association. And then 12 years ago, I think Yoa took over. He'd been the chairman for a long time, and now he's the cannabis spokesman for the Cannabis Retailers Association. But just to keep in mind, Strain Hunters also evolved from there. I started off with the king of cannabis, and everybody was like, what the hell is he doing now again, you know? But the whole reason was to create this figure here in Amsterdam, where celebrities come to the shop and then go back to America and make our case strong, you know? And then High Times helped a lot, of course, by profiling me as king of cannabis. And then people like Woody Harrelson and Rita Marley, Bill Maher, who's very big on talk shows in America, Montel Williams, all those guys came over. I introduced myself as the king of cannabis, and they went back. And then late 90s, you got David Goldsberry with Berkeley Patient Group, Steve D'Angelo with Harborside. They all started the first coffee shops in California with my book. I wrote the book, How to Run a Coffee Shop, in the early 90s already. And so that's where the activism came from. And then after 10 years in 2005, 2006, I was a little bit done with the King of Cannabis. By the way, if you look behind me, which is a huge coincidence because it's the first time I'm sitting here in this place, you can see me with
Busta Rhymes
with the, where he made the song King of Cannabis. You remember that on the thing?
Yeah,
that's really a huge coincidence. That's awesome. Wow. That's awesome. So you can see, you know, we were trying to, because at that time, and the reason I did this all, that's in 95, we came under high pressure of the mayor at that time, like we are under high pressure of the mayor again now, who wants to close us for tourists. You probably heard something about that.
Yeah.
But at that time, that game was already playing. I thought we need international help. So I went back, I said, because at that time, Dutch governments always said, yeah, we are the only one, and we are creating this thing here in this country. And so we were starting to talk to all these politicians, and they said to us, well, you know what? If other countries would legalize, we would not have this pressure from the United Nations Commission on Drugs, you know? So I said, okay, so if other countries are going to legalize, then we're also going to legalize. They all said yes to me. Just to remind you, when you talk to politicians, you always get a knife in your back. And this is like 95, I'm talking about 25 years ago, 26 years ago. And in the meantime, Uruguay, Canada, and America kind of legalized all, and nothing happened in this country. So they were already lying to us at that time. But I thought, you know, I was young, I was 30, I was trying to do something good for the community and trying to get all those celebrities in our coffee shops, which was good for, you know, spreading the word of cannabis, what a great product it is. And it was also good for our company. It was good for our image. We did all these things, you know, at that time. And that's where King of Cannabis and Strain Hunter came from.
I really want to get back to that normalization, because I think you guys should get far more credit for what you've done globally for the movement. But one thing I want to touch on, because you mentioned that the mayor of Amsterdam proposing changing the rules around coffee shops, and this I think should be getting worldwide attention. I mean, Amsterdam is synonymous with coffee shops. I think.
Yeah.
Can you guys tell us what is going on over there? Tell our listeners what this mayor is trying to do, and maybe tell us why you don't think this should happen.
Well, the main problem in Amsterdam is, I think they have the idea that it's exclusive for Amsterdam, but it's not. Any big city in the world, there's many tourists coming, you know, at the moment, but that's not just in Amsterdam. That's also in Paris and London and probably Sydney. You know, there's probably heaps of tourists coming over there, and it's just getting busy. And Amsterdam is a very small. It's basically, if you've been here, we call it the smallest metropole in the world. You know, because it's like a village, but still we have that city feel. You know, but especially the inner city is very small. Yeah. So there's many tourists coming here. And like any other city in the world, the people are wondering, how can we regulate this a little bit? How can we organize this flow of tourists coming to the city? And they have the feeling that the coffee shops are a little bit the magnet for the tourists coming to the city. So it would be a solution to close the coffee shops for tourists. But of course, we think that's not the right solution, because Amsterdam is much more than just the coffee shops. If you guys would come to Amsterdam, you probably would come, you know, because Amsterdam is a liberal city and there's freedom. You know, we have our roots is, you know, freedom is in the roots of our, you know, beautiful city. And there's lots of cool stuff going on. So, you know, and probably you would go to a coffee shop when you are here, but that's not the exclusive reason why you would come.
It's a beautiful city.
So in the end, exactly. So the result in the end would be that you would still come to Amsterdam. You probably still would want to smoke a joint because, you know, the city kind of, you know, it's that whole feeling of the city. So where do you get your weed?
On the street, you know. And if you look at cities in Europe, like Berlin, even Barcelona's got 300 coffee shops, you know, which are not accessible for tourists, and it's busier than ever. Yeah. Berlin, Prague, London, Paris.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't make any sense. And just to give you an idea, which the mayor is referring to, a report that was taken in the red light, and then they only approached 18 to 30-year-old people and asking them what they're doing here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but they didn't approach 40 or 50-year-old. So you get a really crooked result of your so-called scientific report. So, yeah, it's a very crazy situation that we are fighting really, really hard right now. And let's see where this takes us.
It just seems bizarre.
It's bizarre.
that report that Arjan is talking about, it's a research done, you know, it would be similar to being in Sydney and then you go to the Opera House and then you ask the people, is the Opera House the reason that you came here to this spot? And then obviously the people would say yes, because they're standing right there, right? So it's like...
He could have said, are they coming for prostitution? And he would have got the same results.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I think it's a violation of our human rights and everybody's human rights on this world. We've been fighting so hard and so long. And if you see now, the whole world is opening up and only Amsterdam going backwards.
Yeah, that's what I mean by bizarre. It's you guys, your city's pushed so hard to destigmatize. The world is starting to accept that. Like you can see poll numbers around the world. People are increasingly accepting of cannabis. Every year the numbers go up.
Yeah.
And yet here we are in a position with the one city that was the, I guess, the torchbearer for the movement is going to go back the other way. It's really crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope it all works out.
I've taken just 4 minutes. I'll put them on Instagram. They were great.
Yeah, awesome. We can do that. Yeah. Absolutely, man. Yoa, you've given a TEDx talk about normalization of cannabis. It was very good chat, by the way, if that's the only one you've done. I've seen one on YouTube and you did great. I commend you on that one. I want to talk a bit about the normalization because people need to understand that successful, intelligent, clean people consume cannabis. And you two are prime examples. You're both fathers of four, correct?
Yeah, that's coincidentally true. Yeah.
Successful.
Right? He's copying me.
Successful husbands and fathers of large families, stable families, managing colossal businesses. If that isn't a normal thing to be able to do, if you're cannabis consumers and you can do what you are doing, it sort of shoots down this concept that everyone that smokes cannabis is going to become, you know, a couch potato that's got no drive and no ambition in life. You guys are the definition of ambition and drive. You're the definition of stable family environments. So do you want to talk a little bit about how cannabis and being in the industry affects things at home with your families? Do you try and hide it from your families? Do you try and shield them from what you do?
Look at our YouTube and Instagram. We cannot hide it. Already from a young age, they're like, is this in the schoolyard? They're like, is this your dad?
It's sometimes even more crazy than that, you know? Like sometimes it's like, oh shit, you come up on the school area and there's this whoever, the whole group's, can we have a picture? Can we have a picture? And the parents are looking. Luckily, we have friends and we're, you know, we kind of normalized now, so. All the parents are just laughing. And then, of course, on the birthday parties, yeah, your son took a picture with me and you're his legend now and blah, blah, blah. You know, I said, okay.
That's cool.
But the cannabis part is one part of that. But what we teach our children also, it doesn't matter if it's in the cannabis industry or you know, another industry. But if you're passionate about it, then you can, you know, put all the effort in and, you know, you can work long hours and be busy with it. And then every day you would still have a good time, you know, like now we are in a tight spot in Amsterdam. We're fighting for our, you know, existence of the coffee shops. But then still we're doing something that we love, you know. So mainly we try to teach them that. And when as far as it goes to educate your children, we from you know, doing what we do, we can see in real life that it's best thing to be completely open about cannabis, because neither of our children, I have two boys are 4 and 6, so they're too young, but my oldest boys are 16 and 18, and weed is just a normal thing in their life, you know. We're not hiding it, you know. We can't even hide it, you know. When Snoop Dogg is coming, of course, you know, we're rolling a joint at home, you know. And it's just part of life, you know. And if they are 16 or 18 and they drink a couple of beers or they smoke a joint, it's part of the life, you know. If they chill with 40, 50 kids in the park, you know, we are not naive and think that they are, you know, behaving and not drinking, not smoking, you know. So it enables us to talk about it in a normal way with them. So if I speak with my children and I say, hey, you guys smoke, you know, you probably smoke weed, and they can just talk about it. And I say, well, you know, if you do smoke weed, then, you know, maybe you should, you know, try this one, or, you know, a bit more CBD in it. So, you know, it's a bit less, more in balance. And please don't use tobacco, which in Amsterdam still they do, you know, yeah. And that's very annoying. So I'm saying, look, you know, if you do smoke weed, which you're going to do anyway, then, you know, please don't use tobacco, those kind of things, you know, so you can kind of steer them in the right way.
I totally agree that education and openness is, yeah, is the key here. And I think, I mean, we've all been teenagers. I mean, I was taught in high school in my health class that, you know, cannabis causes brain damage and it's going to turn you into a psychotic sort of animal. And just thinking that when you discover that that's not entirely true, it lures you, yeah, a bit more to consume it. And I think the issue then becomes that you don't really know anything about what you're consuming. You don't know where it's come from. You don't know anything about the cultivar or the chemotype that you're consuming. And you go a little bit silly perhaps. So I think having people like you guys around to tell your kids and their friends the safest way to consume, knowing that they're going to be consuming anyway, is the best way forward, surely.
Yeah, look at the history, you know. If you look at America with the 1920s, with the alcohol prohibition, which created the mafia, for, yeah, example. But you also look at the famous Stepstone theory, you know. Okay, when you use marijuana, automatically you're going to use heroin, you know. This was taken for granted for, I don't know, 30, 40 years with this Professor Stone from America. Well, Holland was the first experimental country with marijuana. 1968, Melkweg, Paradiso, the two famous music temples, where Rolling Stones and Prince all made their live albums. That's where it started, with a guy sitting with a little bag in front of the bar selling marijuana, allowed by the Council of Amsterdam. And that turned into the coffee shops later. So if you look at 1968 until now, we're talking about nearly 60 years, or even more than 60 years, 63 years. And at the peak of the heroin epidemic in Europe, we had the lowest amount. And if you look to us now around, and Australia is a bad example, for example, and America right now, the average age of a heroin junkie in Holland is above 55 years old.
Wow.
Where it's in America and Australia, it's 25 years, mm-hmm, old. Mm-hmm. So this whole thing of getting into other drugs because of marijuana is totally bullshit. Marijuana is just a part of the chain. It starts with when you're really young with coffee, tea, alcohol, and maybe a beer. And somewhere in the middle is the sugar, you know, with sugar, which is number one problem in the world.
Yeah.
And then maybe you smoke marijuana. And then maybe if you're, whatever happens in your life, you take heroin, you know. But to just take out marijuana and say, okay, this is the gateway drug towards heroin and cocaine is totally crap. It's misinformation, which is used in the past by politicians for their own agenda, pharma, especially religious churches, all those, yeah, people, you know, against us. And, oh, yeah, and this is the evil, you know. And what happens is they lie to young children, and which is not a good thing, you know. And this is the chain of life that we're dealing with. And when we're looking at sugar now, sugar is killing more people,
yeah,
than all the diseases and all the wars together until now. Can you imagine?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Nobody's doing nothing about sugar. Yeah. When we ask our politicians, oh, no, no, we can't do nothing. That's the industry. Yeah, pharma, same story. Oh, no, no, that's pharma. Yeah, and nobody does nothing. Yeah, some side effects on tobacco and alcohol. Okay, we will put some ugly pictures on the pack of cigarettes. You know what I mean? That's it.
Yeah,
yeah? Those things kill 100 times more people than whole marijuana. But marijuana keeps this stigma and is the enemy of the politician and Mothers Against Drugs, Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan and all these people. You know, this is the reality which we are facing. You know,
it is nice to see a bit of evolution there. With acceptance. So, and I do feel now in my life, the people around me here in Australia, I can speak far more openly and have intelligent conversation with people that I never thought I would, maybe as 5 years ago.
That's, so getting better, but you still can't go to the coffee shop around the corner.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of got to change.
You still have to buy it on the street.
Yeah.
Where in the left hand they got marijuana and the right hand they got ecstasy or cocaine.
Yeah. That's the issue. And I think parents that are scared of cannabis.
Created by our politicians.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And people have to understand that if your kid's going to try a drug, you damn sure want them to try cannabis, to be honest, because at the end of the day, it's the safest. It's got no known fatal dose or not that they can consume in any one day anyway. But instead, we're sending them to a drug dealer's house, a drug den. And like you say, they've got ecstasy in one hand, they've got coke, they've got heroin, whatever else. Meth's huge these days, which is causing a lot of trouble.
Australia meth, yeah?
Australia, meth is it's a menace. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. That is probably the biggest problem right now.
I think so. Yeah,
and I believe heroin's back on the up.
Heroin is back on. I saw last 2 years ago. I saw some university somewhere in Australia where they got some kids using heroin in the toilet, 14, 15, 16 year olds.
Whoa!
Yeah, that's horrible, man.
Which like never happened in Holland, you know?
Yeah. While we're talking about heroin. I've been reading a bit about your history, as has Adam, and we hear about your journey in Thailand, what was it, a 78-year-old man that you met, and he was rehabilitating, I'll say junkies, but heroin addicts.
It's a nicer word.
Yeah, it heroin. Is. Yeah, it's, yeah. Yeah, I don't want to dehumanize people. So you're right. It should be heroin addicts. And can you tell us about, firstly, that man and the place you were and how this journey all began for you, mate?
Yeah, well, this journey is 40 years ago by now. Don't forget that. So the man in the meantime is 120 years old. I was, as you know, I'm a very, very big traveler. I'm on the way to visit country number 94 in March. And this was one of the many countries. I also grew up in Asia, partially Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, because my parents were working there. And on one of my trips, I went with my rucksack through north of Thailand, just traveling around Chiang Rai, Chiang Mai, whatever. You're Australians, you probably know the whole Thailand story and the Bali story and blah, blah, blah. And during my travel, I was just walking into the mountains. I was going somewhere and I passed this village and I needed a place to sleep, and I encountered this group of people that were like heroin addicts, but full on, with this elderly man. And I asked for a sleeping place, and yeah, you come and sleep here and blah, blah, blah. And well, the story is known. I went from one day to 3 days to staying there a week, and the guy really intrigued me. And I, at that time, only occasionally smoked a joint, you know, when I was on the beach in Koh Phangan and stuff like that. And yeah, he started explaining me about that he was curing those people with medical marijuana in his words, you know, which also at that time until, well, I think just very recently medical marijuana got legalized. Joost and Heiko went to Bangkok and advised the royal family of Thailand how to deal with this program. I think now you're allowed to grow 6 plants in your house. I don't know how far that law is, but something is happening in Thailand anyway. But this guy was his way, way, way ahead of time, you know, by using marijuana as a substitute for heroin. And he had big success at that time. Look, I was only 17. I stayed there for a week. I only saw puking people and horrible scenes, you know, because, yeah, you know, coming down from heroin is not the easiest thing to do. That was my first encounter with marijuana. And when I left, the guy gave me this hand of seeds of marijuana. I'm not going to make the story nicer than it is. I've never used those story seeds. I wind it up with other seeds and start growing. But the thing what kept me the most, and look, I still get goosebumps when I think about it because it was crazy. And that's basically what triggered my brain. He gave me this hand of seeds and said, Arjan, these seeds in the future will overthrow governments. That's how powerful they are. Now, of course, until now, they didn't kind of overthrow governments, but it's very highly on a lot of government bills and agendas. And basically, if you look at Trudeau from Canada, the prime minister, before the elections, that was like 6-7 years ago in his first term before he got elected, Trudeau, who was the son of the prime minister in the 70s, by the way, he had only 14% backup. The moment he announced that he was going to legalize marijuana, it went up and he won with a majority his election. Of course, Canada is a very big smoking country like California. So that was smart of him. I think he was also walking in front with the gay people, with the gay march, with the LGBT community, which of course was also very smart to do as a politician. But it just gives you the idea, you know, how powerful this plant is if we all unite. And yeah, unfortunately, we're also a lot of big smokers. There's a lot of rivalry between in the community. But if we would have had a stronger organization worldwide, with backup of people like Soros and Branson with their money, and like now, for example, Elon Musk smoking a joint and saying "fuck you" to everybody. These people, that helps a lot, you know. When the billionaires step in, people listen, you know. So that was my history with the marijuana, when it kind of started triggering my brain. And then I came back to Holland and I started growing when I was 17, 18. And yeah, the rest of the story is history. This was 83, 84, 85. I started making my seeds. And 7 years later in 92, I opened the first coffee shop.
Yeah, that's really cool. And that is cool. Getting to the first coffee shop, man, there's a cool story behind that, because I'm sure people that recently have found out about you, found out about Greenhouse, I'm sure there's this imagination that you just instantly found success. But you persevered, man. You came up with something that you thought would work, and it didn't initially work, did it?
I went nearly broke because I opened April 92 and I was totally alone with my wife. And I had a partner who had a contract because he had four bars, my best friend. Marcel, and he had a contract with Heineken, and then he said Heineken we're going to make a really nice bar in this hood here. It's in the Tolstraat in the south of Amsterdam, and we're going to make a bar. We didn't say nothing about cannabis, and they borrowed us 100,000 guilders at that time, which was a fortune. Yeah, it's like $100,000 basically at that time, you know. And with that money we opened the bar. But like, what I totally underestimated, I thought marijuana was already like likable, you know, but it was only hashish, and there were a lot of hashish coffee shops in Amsterdam, and I was not different than, let's say, the old school guys that were there. I was really young. I was 26, yeah, when I opened that thing, or 27. Yeah. And I was lying the whole day on the couch, sitting on a bar, waiting for customers, and I maybe sold $25 a day. But my wife said, listen, we believe in it. And what we did is we created this artistic cafe. So we had alcohol. And on the outside, you could not see the traditional coffee shop. You know, it was like more like a, you know, like more like a Sydney bar, you know, in a cool neighborhood where people come and hang out, you know, like more a loungy thing. Yeah. I don't know how to explain it at that time, you know, and with mosaics on the wall, homemade lamps over the bar, like really artistic.
Big windows,
lights. You didn't see was a coffee shop, no Rasta flags. No Rasta colors, like really an art cafe, yeah? And nothing happened, mate. And my bookkeepers came in the end of the year, said, Arjen, you have to sell because you're going broke, you know? And I didn't have a lot of money, and I had to pay the 100,000 back, of course. And I kept going, and then 93 April, a year later after opening, John Kennedy passed by, and the Kennedy family had a trust with 40 magazines. In which one was High Times, which at that time was a culture thing, you know, High Times, but was not doing really, really well at that time because the owner passed away, and came in the hands of the Kennedy family. And there is Limo pops up with him and his wife, and they walk into the shop and they said, "You want to enter a competition with Thanksgiving? This is April and Thanksgiving is November, American Thanksgiving." I said, "Yeah, sure, why not?" I had no clue who the people were. I had no clue about the magazine. Seriously, no clue. I was a total virgin. But the only thing I did was I was an illegal grower. And I really, really liked growing. And I was growing already 6-7 years. I was one of the few in Holland growing marijuana. And especially sativas, which still until today, not many people are growing that because of the height and the house and all the illegality. And the guys came in, they had a tip that I was making this weed. Few some tourists who passed by in that year before, you know, and they smoked it. They said, "Arjen, this is really amazing stuff. So that's why I want you to enter." I said, "Okay, well, forgot about the whole thing. It's November," and suddenly 500 people pull up in front of my door, you know, in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, cops came in. What is going on here? And you know, stuff like that. And luckily, I had enough of this one variety, And I called my wife. I called my Marcel, my best friend, who stepped out after 3 months because he was scared of the financial burden we were carrying. So he basically left the shop behind to me. And they all came to help, you know. And then we pulled it off. Everybody was happy. And everybody said, oh, this is great. This is great. But then, yeah, you know, I was a normal Dutch guy. I thought, yeah, you know, you go everywhere. You're tourists. You're going to say it's great, you know, because you're having a good time, you know. And then it was the right opposite here is the old Bulldog. Downstairs was the discotheque. Buddha discotheque.
No? Trans Buddha.
Trans Buddha.
Yeah.
And they rented the discotheque from Bulldog, and there was 1,000 people. But keep in mind, this was the first big international marijuana competition, totally illegal. Yeah. So the press got a hold of it. So there were like 30 CNN, BBC with two teams, South African, I don't know, Japanese television, the whole lot was there. Yeah. And we were standing in the back. And there was 12 coffee shops entering. And we thought, yeah, you know, we're not going to win nothing. We're going to have a great time. We never made so much money in 1 week because 500 people passed by. We were super happy, you know. And then Gatewood Galbraith was there, who was the running for governor of Kentucky. And just for you to remind, Kentucky, before the Second World War, so before 1940, was the richest state of America because they were hemp farmers. When it was still illegal until 1936 or 38, until Harry Anslinger of the DEA fucked up everything. But that's a whole other story. So anyway, the first prize was announced, and Iron of the Greenhouse. And we were looking like, seriously? So we went forward, and then we won like 4 or 5 prizes. And I was a young kid with long hair. You remember me probably, but, you know, dressed up in my hippie stuff. And I was just giving one interview after the other interview. And from that day on, the place was full and trying our new varieties. You know, it was just pure dedication from 83 to 94, basically 11 years of suffering, illegal growing, you know, running away for cops, starting my first coffee shop in an impossible place in the suburb of Amsterdam, which is still until now one of the most problematic places. And that's how it went.
That's
in 3 minutes.
An incredible story. I absolutely love that story.
Yeah, that's awesome.
All filmed. It's all filmed.
So
it's crazy.
How you came along right after that or around when that was happening? Or?
I came in the middle of that. So it just took off at that moment, you know. So I just came from America where, you know, I got acquainted with nice weed because I must admit I also only smoked hash before I left to America, you know. And then where there are so much more about cannabis, came back. And he just won those cannabis, you know, High Times cannabis cups. I was like, wow, man, this is the place to be, you know.
So I needed people. I had nobody. I was alone. I needed to hire people, you know.
Yeah.
Because suddenly the place was people starting to come, you know. I was alone with my wife and there were 50 people in front of me. Can you imagine you have a bar from 0 to 50 or 100, you know. And then Friday night and Saturday night, it went crazy because Friday night I did with my friends, only males. And Saturday night, my wife went with her girlfriends, only females.
That's cool.
Behind the bar. And then, of course, the front of the bar was mixed, you know? So we had a male night and a female night. And my wife was calling me because they were all good-looking girls, of course, behind the bar. She said, Marianne. And they were so drunk. They had no experience in hospitality industry. They just went behind the bar.
We just did something.
They just made a beer, you know? We were a pot. Yeah. We were pot grows. We're not like... I was the only one with a background as a chef. When I was 16, 17, 18, I was making also money in restaurants as a side thing, you know, to survive. Yep. But my wife and her friends, she had zero. They couldn't even work the till, you know. So at 1 o'clock, I came to pick them up. They were like totally wasted. They were like drunk on tequila. And all the money was in a plastic bag. I said, what did you do? We didn't know how it worked, so we just shoved it all in a plastic bag and put a nut in and gave me the bag, you know? That's how crazy it was.
And the accountant was always angry because we gave away way too many drinks, you know?
Yeah, it was more a party than, you know, like we had having fun, you know? And then at one point we came up, we had a wall, it was made of mosaic.
Yeah.
And then my wife and her girlfriend, Yolanda, which is still a really good girlfriend of us, came up with the idea, okay, let's go the Greek way. And then everybody who took a shot could throw his glass against the wall. So around that wall, there was like 100 glasses lying broken on the floor. which then created all kinds of dangerous situations. That's how mad it was, you know? But yeah, we had great fun, mate. We had great fun.
That's so cool. Can we give your wife a shout out, Ayan? Your coffee shop's incredible. And they seem to get better everyone that you open. Brenda's had a fair input into the way you design these things, hasn't she?
Yeah, totally. Our houses, which are basically not visible on the internet because we kind of kept our private life a little bit more private than normally, because of the young kids also, you know. Mm-hmm. But she's very good in interior architecture. So she comes in very, very handy. She has a lot of friends in that field. So like now we just redid all 5 shops in Amsterdam. It was time, you know, after 20, 25 years, and we had nothing to do with COVID. So we said, hey, this is the moment to redo our coffee shops and make them really nice. And so we stayed here from March when COVID started until December, and we did all 5 shops.
Yes.
And yeah, color-wise, and we have Robert Nolet, who's one of the best lamp designers in the world, who lives in my house in Spain, helped us out. And Yoa and me, you know, we do the logistics basically and all the hard work. And so it's, again, here, this is a team effort, you know.
I've seen the footage of you and Yoa. You and Yoa are in these coffee shops just I mean, you guys do the work. I think a lot of people don't probably know that as well. You guys get dirty, you get the tools out, and you build these things. It's really cool to see.
Well, you know, again, here, you can see it all on Instagram. Luckily, we have Instagram these days. We've posted a lot.
Yeah.
You know, like, basically, we painted all the walls ourselves, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's simple as that. We created the lights. We sand the floor. We lacquer the floor at 1 in the night. When everybody's sleeping, we go back and we lacquer the floor. You know, we don't let it somebody else do, because we like it. We do it quicker than other people. We know what we're doing. We are kind of professionals in building also. So it just works quicker. And we are here together. We can't travel. We might as well save money and do it ourselves and do a better job.
It's awesome. It's something you also, sorry.
You create a nicer atmosphere if you do it yourself, you know.
Yeah. It's got your touch.
Pay company a bunch of money and, you know, take care of the building. But I think in the end it pays off, you know, and it gives a much greater personal touch to it.
It's like the clients feel that you make it yourself, like the ambient is in the air, you know, and people realize that this is not just a coffee shop. Yeah. This is also, there's love in this place, you know?
Yeah. As a guest of your coffee shop, numerous times, I must say that you feel so comfortable when you're in there. You just kick back and you go, yeah, this is one of the better places here. You can definitely see that somebody's put some love into the place, put it that way.
Thanks.
And I think with the building side of things, it seems to be something that's fairly common in Europe, where people build their own homes. It's quite interesting. People build their family home, and a lot of my friends that live over there, they've done the building, the majority of the building themselves. So it's really cool to see. Ayan, you mentioned you look at where people are from when you're employing them to see what sort of talents they have or skills. And it definitely seems something across the European landscape that people are willing to go and build their own home, build their own building, and put their love into the place.
Yeah, well, you look at you're talking again where how we recruit people and how they come along, and yeah, it's also probably a part of karma. I don't know how it all happens, but for example, Dust, I've been working with him 3 years in Congo. We've set up that whole factory for the locals, and one of the reasons we took him is that which nobody knows. Everybody thinks the Rasta community evolved from Ethiopia, but it evolved from Congo. Wow. There's 50,000 Rastas in Congo, which is one of the most harsh countries to be and to work in the world. But the reason I took him there is that it's French-speaking, and he's French. We need a builder, and he's a builder. He built 2 houses for himself and for his mother, and he's a Rasta.
Yeah, love it.
So, you know, and we needed a backup of the Rastas there, because otherwise you can't move there, you know. So Rasta, builder, and speaking French, and great grower. So he was the only one who qualified for all 4 things we needed in the world.
Lovely.
Basically.
The Heiko was telling me when I was sitting with him one time over there that with your endeavors in the Congo, the government were trying to preclude Rastas from involvement in the cannabis industry. Is that correct?
Yeah, look, Congo is a country with 700 languages, 400 tribes. It's the size of Europe. I don't know if you know how big it is.
Wow.
But it's, so it's like the north of Europe from Finland down to Gibraltar, Spain is like 3,000. And it's like from left to right, 1,500. That's kind of the size. It's probably close to Australia if you figure it out a little bit different. So it's very difficult. What the hell is going on there? Then there's a lot of international pressure. You know, there's like $1 or $2 billion going in every year from the United Nations into their, let's keep so-called everybody alive, but it's a money-making machine. I've seen over the time horrific things happening with NGOs there, you know, suitcases of money going from one to the other. Unfortunately, that's where a lot of things go these days with these NGOs. So, yeah, you know, then there's the whole mining thing there. There are some metals there that aren't found nowhere else, you know, the stuff that goes in the telephones and
lithium,
all that kind of stuff. Yeah, so, yeah, it's very problematic. Then there's the Americans on one side, then there's the Chinese on the other side. On the south is the South Africans. On the east is the war with the rebels from Uganda, Sudan in the north, you know. And on the top you have the problems with CAR, the Central African Republic. So, yeah, you know, to put your finger on one story there is very difficult. You know, it's just a complicated country.
December 2016, that's when I last sat with you, Arjan. It was before the Christmas of 2016. And the reason I now recall, you were about to head to the Congo to meet up with Franco. And I believe that was
when he died.
That was the fateful trip, which was terrible. And I'd love to talk about Franco a bit, man.
That's the first time I let him go alone, and then shit happened.
Yeah.
That was when we were in Amsterdam all together, actually, that December 2016.
Yeah, whole team seemed to be around, didn't they? Because you were doing Christmas shopping, Arjan. You were buying all kinds of gifts for your team.
I did not live until last March when I came back. I was not for 11 years in Holland.
Yeah, you're in Ibiza?
So I was here probably because of Christmas and seeing family and, of course, I'm here every month talking to Yoa, but not more than 2-3 days because I was occupied in Africa, different places in Africa. We have a factory in Canada, which I was occupied, which I'm also still occupied with. So, yeah, that was we were preparing Franco's trip to there, you know?
Yeah, that's terrible. I think one thing I just want to touch on before we move on to Franco and change the tone. Great to see, like I say, you were doing Christmas shopping, you're riding on your moped, and you were buying some really, really nice gifts, really generous gifts for your team, and bringing them in and asking for shopping lists and stuff. And you even had the kindness to sit down with myself and have a snack and have a chat with me for about 45 minutes or something. And after you left, Yale told me, man, you're so lucky to have experienced that, because Arjan, he comes for 2 days, maybe 3 days at a time, and he's just so busy that he doesn't have time for things like that. So I thank you for giving me some of your time at the Christmas hectic sort of period. I commend you on the way you treat your team, because the love within was well and truly seen, and your love for Franco, man. Anybody that knows anything about you knows how much you love Franco. And talking to your team, Yoa, I'm sure you're exactly the same. You guys, nobody has said a bad word about that guy. And people that have never met, that never got the good fortune to meet Franco, were genuinely distressed and distraught when they found out that he passed. So, Arjan, can you tell me about how you met Franco at the start, how he came into your life, and how much of an impact he had on you, and you too, Yoa? I want to hear about this guy, because he's a legend.
Yeah.
Well, I think we discussed this a little bit earlier. He came on a, he came as a in 2000, 1999 or 2000. He came working on a Wortelplein coffee shop.
Yep.
That's where my wife basically encountered him a few times. And then we had the license from Sim with James Burton.
Yeah.
And I needed a grower, and he was one of the few people. I couldn't go there myself because I was a coffee shop owner. I was not allowed in an official license place in Holland because of my coffee shop background. So I needed to find somebody, and kind of my grows were occupied, you know. So I start talking to him, and then this, along the progress, he said, "Oh man, I'm so passionate. I need to work for you. I need to work for you. I do anything. I will go in the glass house." I said, "Listen, it's hard work. You don't have to be there for 1 or 2 years. It's 50 degrees. I'll go. Tell me what to do. Teach me how to grow and blah, blah, blah." And that's when he started growing there until 2004. And then I came up with the idea, and then he started moving out of there because we left it, because it was a no road at that time in Holland because we were losing a lot of money. So we had to step out of the project. Then Franco came into the seed company with me. And then I launched the whole idea of Strain Hunters. And then I came back to the office. I'll never forget that, because we already had the King of Cannabis story for 10 years. So I'm done with that. Let's now go make documentaries, what I always do, Into the Bush, but now we're going to film it. And Franco's uncle won the film festival of Venice, was a kind of good art film director. So he said, "Yeah, I got an uncle. Maybe he wants to film us. You know, we need some kind." And don't forget, this is all pre-YouTube and everything. Yeah. And so we needed somebody to film it. Everybody was really scared to come, you know. So we really had huge issues. And I said, I came back to the office and I launched my whole plan. And everybody said in the office, "Are you crazy? We're going to go in prison. We're going to get shot." And of course, it was kind of crazy. And we could have got shot and we had issues. And but Franco said, "If you believe in it, I'll come with you. I'm going to do it, you know." And then we shot the first one in Malawi, I think.
Yeah, Malawi.
Malawi, and we did a South African one. And then Franco stayed there. We started making seeds in South Africa for 2-3 years, where one of his kids got born. And, yeah, that was the amazing trip I had with Franco until 2016 New Year, you know, 2017. So we were on the roll, the two of us, for 17 years. We did all the big fairs in America and Canada. We start promoting everything. Of course, Franco spoke Spanish, French, and Italian, which helped a lot. So he was basically doing the Latino countries. I speak fluent German and pretty good Spanish. So I did Switzerland, Austria, and Germany, and in the fairs, you know. And yeah, it was a great tag team, you know. And slowly dust was coming into that team already, and Oscar. So luckily, you know, we had more options. But yeah, of course, it was basically the saddest day of our life when the guy passed away, because the passion he had together with me was fucking unheard of. You know, we were, man, even when we had Vice with us and cameras of HBO, they could not believe it, because at one point, even Vice and HBO, you know, they made some crazy movies. Huh? And we had Jackson, who was the right hand of Shane, the owner of Vice, was private cameraman. And he came with us the first time and said, "Fucking hell, where is this going, man? I thought Shane was crazy, but you guys are, this is another level of craziness, you know?" And they loved it, you know, because the camera was every time in our neck. And you work from 4 to 1. So from basically 4 or 5 in the morning, you stand up, because, you know, when you shoot between 5 and 8, which is the best light in the tropics. And again, in the evening, and you go sleep at 11, 12, 1, depends a little bit how good the beer is and how good the party and how good the bonfire is, you know, in the jungle. And then, but every moment, the guys with the camera are there at 4 o'clock, bam, you know. And Franco had a military background. He was commando. He was 4 years in the Italian army. So he was very disciplined. Not always, but when it was necessary, he was there. And he was a great right hand for me, you know. So, yeah, man, I made 9 movies with the guy. What more can you say, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so, terribly sad.
And he was always on, you know, he was always switched on. It was always full of energy. You could wake him up in the middle of the night and he would join you doing something, you know.
You can,
probably he would be the one, you know, taking the initiative, but always ready.
You can always pick that up. Every bit of footage you see of him, he's, man, that energy is just such a positive, energetic character. And I think that's why he resonated with people so much. Like, passionate for sure. I mean, but a lot of people in the industry are passionate, but Franco, the energy. It was just a unique energy, and I never got the chance to meet the guy, but I can feel it. Adam, at 18 years old, like he's already got a bit of a tear in his eye talking about a gentleman that he's seen on TV. Yeah. It's just a fascinating thing. And speaking of tag teams, I want to bring you into the chat a bit here, Adam, because I know Franco, you got a lot of respect for Franco and his past. Strain Hunters, before we met, you were well aware of them.
Yeah.
I told you when we met, one day you and I are going to interview Arjan.
Yeah, and that was insane.
Here we are. We're sitting with Arjan and Yoa, mate. Yeah. Two absolute superstars. Get into the conversation, dude. You've got to ask some questions about the Strain Hunters while we're on it.
Yeah, well,
what we could do in 1 year is we could come up with Dust, and then we could come after we made the movie and give you guys some nice scoops on that thing, you know.
Oh,
to have a nice follow up on the thing, you know.
That is awesome.
It would be great.
But that's beautiful.
I won't say where we're going because we're keeping this kind of secret, of course, for security reasons, because some governments or military regime or police officers really don't like us, as you can imagine. So, you know, we try to come in as tourists in the country and then shoot our thing. And by the time they know us, we're gone already, you know? So
yeah,
that's how we roll.
Yeah. That's really cool. I should say about 6 months ago as well, just meeting Scott at some random shop around the corner from me, which sells fittings, like pipe fittings. And he's telling me these crazy stories that he's hanging out with Arjan, someone that I've watched on Strain Hunters at 16, consuming things that I shouldn't be. And, you know, it's just insane that I have this opportunity to speak with you guys and just chill out. And I think it's super, super cool. Looking at Scott right now, he's looking a little teary. And, you know, talking with like Frenchie Cannoli and even you, Arjan, like your stories of being 18, 17, in the mountains in some crazy places just seems so insane to me. So, yeah, I really appreciate what you do for the cannabis community. And, yeah, I'm kind of trying to follow in your footsteps.
Do that.
Yeah.
If you're passionate about it, you just follow that passion, man. And, you just follow that road that you have ahead of you. And, you know, and then it will come.
Don't listen to all the bullshit around you.
Yeah. And I really think in our industry, good things happen to good people, you know? So, you know, if you just stay on that path and, you know, you will get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got to say, when you did first come, a bit of background, we own an agricultural store and we sell irrigation fittings and fertilizers and things. And Adam came in buying some
our fertilizer.
Yep.
Yeah, we do sell greenhouse powder feed. Actually, we do, man. But we both personally love your product.
Speaking of a lot, that is greenhouse fertilizer. Now we were the first ones with powder, where everybody
said,
"Here
we go." Cool.
That's cool. Yeah, we're coming out with a starter kit now for people with a small tent, which is really great.
That is cool.
Little box. You'll see it soon, but yeah. When we started that thing, also everybody said powders are impossible, you know?
Yeah.
And we were thinking more about the environment, you know, why you're walking around with all these liquids, why you're making it so complicated with 7 steps and 10 steps and 3 steps, when you can have a simple person working with not a simple, we call it keep it simple, but it's a complicated fertilizer, but it's all in one and it works really, really well.
Yeah.
Until now, still somebody has to prove us that something else is better in powder stores than this one, you know? And last year we doubled people using this powder feeding. So just give you idea how this thing is going, you know? And you see also like now big companies copying us, you know, with powder, which is fun, which is great.
You'll get a buzz out of this. Episode, I think, 17 of Canter?
Yeah, I think so.
I think episode 17, it is titled Keeping It Simple with Yarn from Greenhouse.
Yeah,
it's a whole episode around that line.
You guys did that one already.
Yeah, man. Yeah, we spent a whole hour with Jan running through your line.
Jan told me, I saw that in the email passing by.
And
yeah,
that was awesome. It was our first time we got to chat with Jan, and we both said to Jan afterwards, after we stopped recording, that we felt like we knew him straight after. It was really cool, and it's really great when you meet meet people in the industry, particularly through this podcast, and you finish up and you go, "Wow, I've got a friend here that I can catch up with in the future, and someone that's going to be around for a long time in my life." And Jan's certainly one of those people. So once again, a shout out to Jan.
Yeah.
Love that, David.
Well, whenever you guys are in Amsterdam, you also have a place to stay. You can come and see us, and we'll hang out.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's cool.
Absolutely, that's love awesome. The yeah. offer. What about Adam? You got some questions for these boys, right?
I think we've kind of covered pretty much about everything.
I've absolutely loved sitting with you guys.
We do a sequel like Arjen suggested.
Yeah. I love the sound of that. And that's a really generous offer, guys.
Yeah,
so,
that's awesome.
Can't thank you enough. As we said before we started recording, honestly, the first time I've been genuinely shaking prior to recording. you guys have been great. You've been so hospitable to us, so nice. And I think that any naysayers against you guys, I'm sure they haven't spent too much time with you, because you're clearly a great team and great people and cannabis people, and the world needs more like you. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, man.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been awesome.
Thank you.
See you next time. Hello to all the people, and keep watching your guys' show.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Really appreciate it.
A great day, Australia. Hope to be back there one day.
Definitely. That's awesome.
Thank you so much, guys. Take care, and all the best with this coffee shop scenario.
Yeah.
I hope it works out well for you.
It will.
And you don't wear too much loss from it. So all the best, guys.
Otherwise, we'll go to Australia. Don't worry.
<That's it. laughs> Cheers, guys. Take care. See you, guys.
Ciao.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Canter. Any guest views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and not necessarily those of the hosts. Canter strongly suggests listeners research local, state, and federal laws and regulations before conducting any cannabis-related activity.